Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fraggle Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda. I'm very happy today to welcome Jeremy Lent to the podcast. Jeremy's a British author whose writings investigate the patterns of thought that have led civilization to its current crisis of sustainability. He is the founder of the non-profit Leology Institute, which is dedicated to a worldview that could enable humanity to thrive sustainably. He's the author of The Patterning Instinct and Requiem of the Human Soul. Well, so thank you very much, Jeremy, for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Well, great. It's a pleasure to be here with you, Fergal.
A good place to start, maybe, if you could just talk a little bit about your background and the Leology Institute. I mean, I came across your recent book and The Patterning Instinct, but maybe just talk a little bit, you know, the journey you've been on.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely, Fergal. I actually was born in England, was educated and grew up in England, went to Cambridge. And then I left England and I spent most of my life actually in the United States. And just in simple terms, you can sort of break my life into kind of two halves, if you will, because my first half of my life was actually spent in business. I got an MBA at the University of Chicago, the absolute center, as I'm sure you know, for, you know, Milton Friedman style monetarism, all that kind of stuff. And then I went into consulting and I ended up starting my own internet company during that first internet phase back in the 1990s. it was actually a company that was the first ever to allow people to apply for credit cards online and get approved in real time. It was a success, and I actually ended up taking the company public. And then things started to sort of turn very different for me in my life. My wife at the time, she passed away some years back. She got very sick. I left the company to look after her. Left the company really before the time was ready. I was CEO at the time, and within a few years, it actually collapsed and went under. And my wife sadly went through cognitive decline. So I kind of really lost her. And I went through this place in my life where I was really asking myself, where does meaning come from? Like I realized I had this opportunity to move my life in a whatever direction I chose, but I wanted it to be really meaningful. And then ever since then, this was well over 10 years ago, I spent the time really trying to understand the source of that meaning. Part of that was to look at the different ways in which cultures all through history have patterned meaning into the universe, because I wanted to really get a sense of not just take for granted ideas that we have right now. And that led to me writing this book, The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning, which really does look at the different ways in which cultures, all the way from earliest times of hunter-gatherers, have made meaning out of the world. And perhaps most importantly for this podcast, it looks at the underlying values of our modern civilization, where those come from, where the worldview that we hold actually comes from, which is quite fascinating, and also begins to hint at some of the unsustainable areas that we are in right now. So actually, it was actually as I was doing this research on this book that I really began to see that because our own worldview has these unsustainable elements to it, as leading to these imbalances, there's an opportunity for a different kind of worldview, one that's based more on connection, that can lead to really more of a harmonious form of existing on the earth. And that is underlying this Leology Institute that I founded some years back, which is really designed to offer a framework for a more sustainable worldview for long-term flourishing on the earth. And actually, my current writing is about those themes. So right now I see myself really as an author and an integrator, trying to integrate different aspects of history and philosophy and our lives into a more fulfilling, so essentially a more integrated worldview.
I'd love to talk to you a little bit more about the patterning instinct later. What would be useful maybe is you touched on this question of sustainability and unsustainability. I mean, how are we doing? I mean, I know Steven Pinker just published a book that has been, well, lauded mostly, but has had some critics as well, that we're doing very well in relative terms over, compared to where we were, and, in terms of getting rid of disease and war and so forth and things like that. How do you think we're getting on? I mean, and what's on your mind? What are a few of the biggest concerns that you have from the perspective of sustainability, at least?
There's sort of two big themes, I think, that you just brought up. One has to do with sustainability. One has to do with progress. So certainly Steven Pinker's notion that he has been publicizing a lot is this idea that we're on this incredible path of progress, and all these people, like, he really, really has it in for people who focus on the environment, who he thinks are just missing the really big picture. And he's a big supporter of the sort of techno-utopian type people who think that things can go just really great if we just invest more in technology, which I see as more of a neoliberal sort of technocratic approach to things. And as I read his book, I got really quite angry, because even though I've actually really agree with a lot of what Steven Pinker says about progress, and his earlier book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, I thought was profound and really important, because it shows how there has been significant moral progress in history. But where I part company from him significantly is he makes a big point in his most recent book of tying progress in with essentially the capitalist model of the last few hundred years. And he essentially really conflates the two. So the underlying message of his book, in fact, the overriding message of his book, he's pretty explicit about it, is we have progress because of Enlightenment values, and because those Enlightenment values led to the capitalist global economy, and we should be so glad for that. And people who disagree with that are just missing the boat. So I wrote this article, actually called Steven Pinker's Ideas About Progress Are Fatally Flawed. These eight graphs show why. And I focused on the graphs because a lot of what he does is he tries to sort of overwhelm the reader with so much data that you just can't disagree. In the end, you go, well, I guess he must be right. Actually, the reason for my anger was this recognition that he seems to be deliberately missing things that don't fit in with his worldview he's trying to offer. And I think, honestly, doing it in a manipulative and cynical fashion. And what I try to show in my graphs is kind of extricate the progress from neoliberal capitalism. And I agree that we have, as a world, at least the human race, has enjoyed substantial progress in moral values, and also in the quality of life, material quality of life overall, over the last millennium and the last few hundred years. But I think there's two key points. One is the reason for that progress is not, in my view, the capitalist system. It's actually the rise of scientific thought and Enlightenment values, which I think are different from what Steven Pinker shows. And they're also as a result of people caring about what is wrong in each generation and putting literally their lives on the line to make things better. And I think that's the issue that I think Steven Pinker is so wrong on. He just misses that. But the other thing that's so important is that this whole idea of progress is very selective. And in fact, if we look at what is really going on right now, we see a whole other sort of version of events. The whole issue of overshoot, the issue of progress for whom, the fact that, in fact, it's incredibly, like, the rise in inequality has led to a disastrous experience for the bulk of people on the earth right now. And in fact, what we find is that if we want to enjoy any positive progression into the future, we have to change the economic model the world is based on right now. And I believe have to change some of our underlying values as a global civilization.
Right. Now, you've covered a lot of ground there. Very interesting. Just coming back to the sustainability question, what are the few things? I mean, as you say, you look around, you've got every day in the newspaper, there's, you know, more ice that's been melting on the Antarctic or different glaciers. You've got biodiversity. We've got, you know, supposedly extinction. We've got climate change. We've got various major and traumatic concerns. Are there a couple that are on your mind in particular?
Yes. I mean, I think without doubt, of course, you know, the climate breakdown is what's on everyone's mind. And that is clearly at the current rate is so extreme that I think there's a very, very good question as to whether the path we're on right now is really consistent with having a maintaining civilization this century. I think it's as extreme as that. And that, you know, that recent PNAS article about hothouse Earth, it was called The Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene, that's really brought to light some of these key underlying issues that, and even if we keep global warming to that 2 degrees that was never really established by scientists as a safe limit, but was just kind of a number that got politically acceptable, that actually in itself could lead to positive feedback effects that could lead to unsustainable climate change into the future. You know, we're already seeing our civilization begin to show the sort of cracks in the system with just 1 degree Celsius. So I think that's a massive problem. But, you know, even beyond that, I'm glad when I see people focusing on climate change because it's this absolute existential risk to our civilization. But there's so many other underlying massive problems beyond it that we barely even aware of. And we're looking at things like deforestation, a massive crisis of potable water. We're looking at things like the fact that at the current rates of topsoil overuse, we maybe only have 60 harvests left, according to a United Nations study. And it goes on and on. The sixth extinction of species. The oceans are basically 90% of some of the major fish in the oceans have disappeared. And we're essentially using the Earth up at it's an incredibly unsustainable rate. So I think we have to look at some of the underlying reasons for this and shift where we're going.
Yes. Yes. You touched on, interestingly, at the beginning, you were talking about the capitalist system and you talked about the Anthropocene. Is it the capitalist scene, as far as you're concerned? I mean, you've highlighted, I think, in the recent writings, the issues associated with capitalism and the problem. Can you talk a little bit about how you see that?
Yeah, I do think that in our current global system, the gigantic transnational corporations are the ones that we have to recognize are a major fundamental driver of our sort of unsustainable path that we're on right now. And I'm not sure, honestly, that I'd call it the capitalist scene, even though I know everyone's trying to come up with a new version of the something-o scene. But I do think the Anthropocene is probably a good way of looking at things because, you know, as I really research in detail in my book, The Patterning Instinct, we do see certain unsustainable trajectories that have gone on ever since humans really evolved as a species. And I mean, even when we were hunter-gatherers, as soon as we got into a new continent, within a couple of thousand years, there'd be this major extinction of megafauna in each continent. Because basically, as humans, we have more power than we know what to do with over the rest of the natural world. So there is this larger arc. But in recent times, what I have really observed, certainly in the last century, is that not just the rise of global capitalism, but the rise in recent decades of the transnational corporations has really infiltrated every aspect of life. So it's gotten to the point where it's hard to believe, but 69 of the top 100 economies in the world today are actually corporations rather than countries. And, you know, we see their effect in just every aspect of life. So as infants just grow into their culture, the global advertising, the sort of corporate-driven media that they have that they are inundated with shape their values, shape their lives, and really turns them from being primarily human beings into primarily consumers in order to maintain the growth in corporate earnings, basically.
Yes. I'd be interested to talk to you a little later about your views on the corporations and indeed finance and so forth. But a key interest of yours, clearly, Jeremy, is this question of culture and values. What, in your view, are the underlying values that have, do you think, that have given rise to global capitalism and its more extreme market fundamentalism that we've seen in the last 30 years?
Well, what's interesting is I think if you look at deeper layers, we see core fundamental values that we just take for granted in our world, a lot of them coming from the rise of the scientific revolution in the 17th century or so, when philosophers started to look at this notion of conquering nature as being this ultimate good, and recognizing, sort of seeing nature as a machine, that if we can sort of take it apart, then we can just make life better and better for human beings. And even underlying those ideas, this notion of humans as being basically separate from nature, and this idea that it's actually that humans are fundamentally selfish and that it's actually good that they're selfish, that this kind of reinterpretation of Adam Smith, because it wasn't his initial ideas, but this modern interpretation is that, you know, one is that humans are very individual, that we sort of need to define ourselves as individuals rather than within community. And two, that as individuals, we're fundamentally selfish. That's a good thing, because when all humans act rationally on their selfishness, this makes for a more efficient economy and it makes for a better world for all. And these are myths, essentially created by, you know, people in the 17th century doing their best to make sense of things, reacting against millennia of theology and Christendom or whatever. But their ideas have been superseded by science in over the last few centuries and certainly the last few decades, and yet those myths are what we take for granted in the way we make sense of the world. And those myths are actually propagated to a large extent by the corporations, because they help to buttress this kind of underlying philosophy of neoliberal capitalism, that because we're selfish, because life works better when we all pursue our own gains. Really, the role of government should be to let corporations just make as much money as possible and make the markets as efficient as possible.
Yes, efficient markets. That's another question, I guess, another contradiction or myth as well. You talked about science there. Clearly, science has brought us great things. What happened, though, is you know, as a tool, and indeed various aspects of, you could say, the Industrial Revolution, or being able to divide and split, the Fordist Revolution of breaking tasks down and things. They have produced great wealth, and in certain political circumstances have not had problems of equality. Indeed, after the Second World War and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about the connection between those?
It's true, and that's something I like to emphasize, because sometimes I get so focused on the negative aspects of some of the modern trends in our global worldview that people misinterpret and think that I'm sort of attacking these sort of some of the other fundamental elements of our worldview, which are so good. And I think we can be so grateful for science and for technology and the amazing benefits that it's brought. And that's where I really agree with, for example, Steven Pinker's analysis of progress. And along with that, scientific worldview also has come with some wonderful notions of expanding humanity's sense of community, from not just being within our sort of tribal identity, but some of these ideas, the concept of freedom and liberty applying to all of humanity, came out of that same scientific revolution of thought, which led to the Enlightenment. So that is absolutely true. And so what I try to identify in my book is more that what we've looking at now is an imbalance, that the worldview that breaks things down and sometimes called the reductionist approach to science, that has done so much to enhance our technology and enhance humans' power over the world, has led to this massive imbalance with the natural world, and also massive imbalance within our societies, leading to these incredible inequities, where right now, for example, the six wealthiest men in the world own as much wealth as the entire lower half of the world's population. Just unbelievable.
Now, yes, it's very interesting. And while I understand, I think, you know, this reductionist idea and what you're talking about and the deep-rooted aspects that this has, this philosophy and how that's played out. But I guess if you're looking for a simple solution, maybe there isn't one, but you're trying to find one in some sense, we would have to look really, I think, to the last 30 years. I'm just wondering what happened in our values and our culture that allowed the corporations, that allowed this idea of globalization, that allowed this idea of profit maximization, that allowed this idea of footloose capital, you know, if we're looking at just that aspect of it.
Yes, well, I do think that we need to look at the sources of this last few decades as being that rise in neoliberal thinking that came became popularized with Margaret Thatcher and Reagan. And of course, you know, before then you had these sort of ideas of people like Hayek coming from the sort of Mont Pelerin Society, like this group of people back in the as early as the 40s and 50s and 60s, who put together this alternative worldview and managed to invest enough money and do it systematically enough that essentially it's taken over the thinking of the world. I mean, it was one of the great successes of a sort of a worldview coup, if you will, in all of history.
Why was it ripe? You know, because as you say, it has been very successful. It's only now, really, and well, to whatever degree it is, that, you know, there's some questions at various levels as we see financial bubbles, degradation of the environment and issues like that, and the degrowth thinkers and things are more fundamental, you know, questioning. But it is an idea that took hold and obviously very seductive.
Yes, and I think that really one simple element is that it was the result of a small group of people, you know, applying a very clear mythology and funding it hugely and doing so systematically, so that when they had the opportunity to essentially infiltrate governments in the West, they were able to do so and then really like use these massive funds they accrued to take over the media, so that now in the United States in particular, most of the media is either controlled. I mean, even the media that we see as more sort of quote independent and, you know, not supporting this kind of Trump regime in Washington is still controlled by gigantic corporations and almost never mentions the climate breakdown we're looking at, almost never mentions the role of the corporations in this, because they are the mouthpiece of corporations. So it's like a sort of choice in the US right now is between the extreme right wing supporting this kind of Trump regime of a complete breakdown of all prior norms for essentially nothing than a kleptocratic takeover of the country on the one hand, and on the other hand, a mainstream media which is dominated by massive corporations that wants to essentially keep a more balanced takeover of the world by the gigantic transnational corporations, but in the sort of form of slightly more of a sense that could be bought into by by a broader swath of people. But you say very, very little conversation about what's really needed, which is a transformation of our way of thinking, a transformation of our economic system.
Yes, absolutely. And I'd like to talk to you about your ideas and that. Just last question would be, about, again, because your interest in the cultural side of things, what is your sense of the cultural roots of this particular, you know, neoliberal turn?
What's interesting in my book is that I sort of go deeper and deeper into these layers. So you can sort of, that I wish there was a really crisp answer to your question, but in a way it kind of, it goes layer by layer. So most recently we see this like takeover of essentially of common thinking by consumerist ideology, which really started at the beginning of the 20th century in the United States. Then prior to that, you have this layer of this kind of belief in humans as being separate from nature, separate from each other, and the right of Europeans essentially to conquer the world, to conquer nature and to conquer other countries. But then you can even peel the layers further and go behind that and look at the Christian worldview that was based on this, what's called dualism, this sense of the separation of the soul and the body and the separation of humans from nature and the sort of source of value being up in them, sort of in the heavens and God rather than in actually in the earth. And you can even find that going all the way back to the ancient Greeks. So even though I'm not accusing the ancient Greeks of causing our current society, it is fascinating to look back and see some of the roots of these senses of separations coming from them. And I do think that diagnosis is valuable. It sounds very kind of academic and sort of arcane, if you will. But the reason it's valuable is it leads us to recognize what we can do to turn things around, which is if our fundamental issues are around separation, a sense of separation of humans from nature, humans from each other, even separation within ourselves, then the real turnaround comes from focusing on connection. On connection with each other, connecting within our own values, within ourselves, connecting with community, realizing that we all as humans are connected in a global sisterhood and brotherhood, and then fundamentally connecting with the earth, realizing we're not separate from nature. We actually are nature. And it's only when the earth is actually flourishing that we humans can really flourish for the long term.
That's a beautiful vision, Jeremy. And in the great scope of time that you've explored in your book, what is your sense of how change happens? That is a big question, I'm sure.
Well, that is a great question. Yeah, thank you for answering that, for asking that. I do think that is core. And what I discovered really in my book is that, worldviews can be incredibly sticky. I mean, they can last for millennia. They have this real power of, as kids grow up, each new generation, they form this worldview from their parents and the world around them, and they believe in it fundamentally. So how do worldviews change? And what I see happening is it's only when there is some significant either endogenous or exogenous variable that changes substantially that can leads new generations to really question the values of prior generations. So when we saw the worldview changing with the scientific revolution in the 17th century, that was an endogenous variable of this kind of shift of ways of thinking that led to a new way of understanding the world that was incompatible with what was previously there. But then if you look at another example, if you look at China, which had this very sustainable, traditional worldview that was one based on a sense of connectivity, a sense of everything being connected in the web of life. And what's so fascinating is you see that worldview shifting when there was this dramatic a sort of earthquake, if you will, of the West with a different worldview coming in and humiliating the leadership in China for decades and decades and decades until new generations arose and said, we've got to throw out this worldview that was rotten. And essentially, they incorporated Western worldviews in one way or another, either in the form of communism or more recently in the form of capitalism. So we see worldviews change when something significant causes an unraveling of the old worldview. And that's actually, believe it or not, where I see hope right now. Because even as we're looking at this move towards disaster in our climate breakdown and all of the other unsustainable paths we're on, we're seeing new generation of people as they're looking at things, saying, this is unacceptable, and the way, like the values that have led our civilization to this world that I, as a young person, need to grow up in, I don't accept that. And I think that we're beginning to see some of the unraveling of the old ways of thinking in younger people. The big question And I think this is the biggest question really facing humanity is, will the worldview unravel and be transformed first, or will our actual economic system unravel to the point of collapse before the worldview has a chance of changing it? So it's almost this race of what's going to unravel first, the old way of thinking or the old way of doing business, which could potentially lead to the collapse of our civilization, which would be really the greatest disaster ever to have occurred in all of human history.
Yes, yes. You're right to emphasize the importance of civilization. The Earth will continue, and evolution of one kind or another will continue, presumably. But yes, our civilization is a terrifying prospect, particularly when you think about the levels of CO2 already baked in, as it were, and where we are on that trajectory. Yet, at the same time, as you point out, there is... quite a bit of momentum, and it does feel like a moment of potential change. Now, you've recently written a piece with some recommendations, some suggestions, some things that you think would help, things that we need to do. Can you talk about those a little bit? We touched on the importance of the key role that growth-seeking corporations have had on the world. Before I just ask you about that, I just want to say, corporations obviously have this power, yet we are part of this too. We are part of this. We buy stuff, and we buy a lot of stuff, particularly in the developed world. And our pensions are in the stock market, which is investing in these companies. So how do you extricate us or the companies from that kind of connection?
Yes, I agree. And it's also everything, because everything is interrelated. We can't just look at one layer, if you will, of this incredibly complex system and ignore the other layers. So even though I focus a lot on corporations, but ultimately it is our underlying values that need to shift. But what we have to recognize is that each of us really is embedded in this system. So, our kids grow up and getting indoctrinated by the media that they are exposed to, which is designed to turn them, into consumers. And as we get older, we get embedded in a company and a family and the way the system works right now, just in order to pay the rent or pay the mortgage, get our kids to school, look after our health and all those things. We have to essentially become cogs in this gigantic corporate system. If we're lucky, sometimes we can feel we can sort of tell ourselves, well, we're doing something good in our lives while we're doing all this. But it's very, very difficult to actually extricate ourselves as an individual from this system unless you're either very fortunate or very committed and ready to give up a lot of what we thing that we see around us that other people have access to. So that's why we do have to change some of the things systemically. We do need to change our own values. But as long as we're embedded in this incredibly complex system, none of us individually can necessarily do enough. But we can do things if we work together to shift some of the kind of rules of the game, if you will, some of the overriding politics and the underlying rules that lead us to this pace we're in right now. And I do think to understand that, we have to look at what is the system based on? And very simply, if we recognize that the corporations do have this incredible power in the world right now, we have to look at the fact that corporations themselves are designed in our modern world to maximize shareholder value. And to do so, their whole intention is to keep growing. And of course, as we all know, if a corporation puts out quarterly earnings and says that its growth rate might be reduced by something or other, its stock crashes right away. And if the CEO makes a decision to do something that won't lead to maximizing shareholder value, he or she risks being sued by shareholders for doing that.
Yes, so, yes. Does that mean that the real focus of attention should be investors? Because as you say, I can't remember what the quote, during the financial crash, one of the bank CEOs said, well, you've got to keep dancing. The idea that it's actually the investors that, and I know there's been research Daniel Nyberg has done on trajectory of corporations in Australia who started out with a sustainability agenda and over time dropped that. It became narrowly defined as sustainability of the corporation. And he talks, you know, to quite some degree about the, you know, the role of key stakeholders in that. Yeah, so I'd be interested to get your views on the role of investors.
Yes, I mean, investors definitely play a huge part. And even then, I think we have to look at the underlying system that drives investors as much as drives the corporations. So if you go to a corporate CEO, and he or she might say, well, I've got to do what I do because of investors. But if you go to investor, they will say something similar. I've got to do what I've got to do. Otherwise, I'll lose my job. If I'm not trying to, you know, maximize my returns, I'll just get kicked out. So what is the system that causes each person to be doing what they need to do, driven by some underlying dynamic? And I think... And that's where I have suggested a few interim paths that even taken together, I don't think they actually give us the true structural transformation our civilization needs. We actually have to shift our civilization to a different kind of an integrated network, really from fundamentally. But I do think that there are some steps which... Even though I just see them as incremental, they are so radical, if you will, compared to modern thinking that very few modern politicians would even kind of touch them. But to give you an idea, one idea I came up with is this notion of a triple bottom line requirement for corporate charters. I expect a lot of people who listen to this podcast are probably familiar with the idea of the triple bottom line of companies choosing to optimize not just profits, but also people and planets. So like social, environmental, and financial outcomes. And you can actually charter, you know, recharter as a benefit corporation or what's alternative thing known as a B Corp. And something like over 2,000 corporations around the world have done so. But the problem is that when you do that, you're still part of this global capitalist system. And if you can't show that you're still making your profits the way that people expect, it's just not going to work. And, you know, companies like Unilever, who have talked a good talk and really offer good values, and Danone is another example, they are still stuck having to fight again in a system that only optimizes for shareholder value. So the idea would be to actually establish a rule this would have to be a shared international rule in the US as well as in Europe and other countries that say that corporations have to be chartered according to those three bottom lines rather than just optimizing shareholder value. So then if a CEO made a decision that was good for the environment or good for the local community, then he or she could not be sued because they're actually pursuing some of those triple bottom lines. And along with that, I think charters should need to be renewed every 5 years. There's no reason why corporations should be given this perpetual charter, especially in the United States where they have the rights of a person. But it's like they have to, they're immortal, unlike people. And essentially, they get to act like psychopaths, if you will, because they're just solely focused on one thing, regardless of the moral and issues around them. But if they actually had to get their charters renewed every 5 years, everything would look different. All of a sudden, corporations would start to essentially make decisions in different ways. So those are two of the ideas that would really change the underlying rules. So the system is still the same. It's still global capitalism, but the little tweaks, if you will, with very significant impact.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, just in response to another thing you mentioned, there is another idea that I put out there in this article, talking specifically about investment holding periods. Because to your point about investors, one of the issues is the incredible short-term orientation of investors. So, you know, and corporations know that investors can buy or sell their shares at a moment's notice. And of course, with same-day trading, essentially, and everything is driven by where the sort of short-term money is going. So that can be changed again very simply. And again, it would be a radical transformation of the current system, but it would just be a tweak of the rules of simply taxing the trades based on how long they're held. So you could put a penalizing tax of, say, 10% if a stock is held less than a day. And that can be a sliding scale of, say, 5% if less than a year, or 3% if less than 10 years, and zero if more than 20 years. So that in mutual funds and the big money that kind of shifts around right now would have to look at the longer term plans of a company and would stop investing in, say, fossil fuel companies, because they know that their days are numbered, and would start investing more in companies that offer, say, green renewable energy, or investing in long-term sustainability of water and other longer-term flourishing-oriented companies.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Now, you mentioned this question of a triple bottom line. There does seem to have been some momentum here in terms of increased awareness or agreement that, you know, actually, legally, at least in the United States, corporations don't have to maximize profits. And, you know, this question of, you know, fiduciary role and so forth, and the special position that, you know, shareholders have in terms of, you know, getting the highest returns is actually doesn't hold in either in law or corporate economics or questions like that. And yet, apparently, it's the Supreme Court in Delaware that calls these decisions, and what it says goes. So, you know, what is your sense? Have you thought about how this change might happen? And I mean, because this, you know, this awareness of the, you know, the, I guess, mythical quality of this idea of, you know, which every CEO says, oh, well, we've got to maximize profits, and, you know, we've got this fiduciary responsibility. It's not true.
Yes, you're completely right. It's not true according to the actual letter of the law, in the sense that there's no explicit requirement. Like if you look at, say, Delaware corporate charters, where most of the big corporations are incorporated. But there's been a century of case law that's kind of entrenched this principle. And so the, you know, law is not just a matter of what the charter says, but how case law has been interpreted. And so we have seen this ever since there was a famous Ford Motor case about 100 years ago, which kind of set us on this path. But then again, in just the last 20 or 30 years, it's become sort of considered the de facto standard of operation in big companies. So that even though it's not actually in the charter, it is something that does have the power of law, because shareholder lawsuits have been won on this basis. And so quite appropriately, a CEO is going to be afraid if they don't act according to that, because their job really would be at stake. So I do think that the only way to change it is to actually put a change in the actual law, essentially saying to corporations, you have to be chartered according to these three explicit bottom lines. And that, I think, would lead automatically to a shift in priorities. And you know where I'm actually amazingly hopeful? When I wrote this article just a couple of months ago, it's called Five Ways to Curb the Power of Corporations and Billionaires. I wrote in this article, you know, these ideas are so radical that even though they don't actually change the underlying system, they're so different from what's accepted that, you know, no mainstream politician would touch them with a barge pole. And yet, to my delight, and just last week, Elizabeth Warren, who is a possible contender for the presidential nomination for the Democratic Party for the 2020 elections, actually came out with a bill aimed a sort of along the lines of what I wrote about in this article. It's called the Accountable Capitalism Act. And it basically says that if corporations want to be viewed as persons, they actually have to not be psychopaths. They actually have to have moral values, and they need to look at getting they can actually get their charter revoked if they acted essentially immorally or irresponsibly. So she's actually moving on the same principles as what my article was talking about. And here's a politician who stands a real possibility of being our the next president of the United States. So that gives me some hope that some of these ideas may turn out to be mainstream quicker than we think.
Well, yes, it's a very optimistic perspective, and great to see it being discussed in that way. Just one last question then on the investor front. How much progress do you think is being made? There's a lot of momentum in various different organizations in terms of responsible investment, ESG. There's talk now of the EU, I think, has been for some time looking at redefining the fiduciary duty of investors to include ESG. You've had some, you know, major signatories of different kinds of investors and so forth. How real do you think this change is? Are they just shuffling things around, and on the, you know, or do you see a deeper, more fundamental change?
That is a great question. I think both of those things are true. I do think there is a shift in the climate, so that I mean, I didn't mean that as a pun, but obviously because of the climate breakdown, there is a shift in the climate of thought around this, and most responsible people around the world, and even people who are very wealthy, who made their money out of the system of the last few decades, realize that something has to change. So I do see some hope there, but at the same time, I also see a lot of greenwashing, or if to sort of change metaphors, kind of shifting deck chairs on the Titanic, if you will. And I think that one of the reasons for this is because people are still not ready to come to terms with the fundamental shifts that are needed if we are to avoid this breakdown. That it's not just a matter of more investment in renewables. It's not just a matter of companies paying more attention to social responsibility and all this kind of stuff. It's the very structures of our economy and the very structures in which we live our lives have to shift if we're going to avoid a real breakdown. And people aren't yet willing to look at that. And that's where I see some real issues that where what we need to do is raise people's awareness to how much things need to shift, and also to give a positive vision for where they can shift to. There's a notion out there that's called an ecological civilization, which offers a sort of a vision for a different kind of civilization than the one that this one's been built on, which essentially is sort of, you know, global capitalism, which is based ultimately on money as the kind of source of value, both of cultural value as well as individual values. And an ecological civilization would be different. It would be one where the growth was in the growth in quality of life, not in how much material possessions you had. And that quality of life would come through a sense of sustainable living, and a sense of you know, of richness in community, and a sense almost like of a fractal way of connecting, with a lot more focus on the local level, but not in a kind of tribal putting up barriers kind of localism, but more like recognizing that each different community is part of a fractal, part of a national groups and international groups, and part of the whole earth system, and really optimizing for what was healthy, the decisions that were healthy, both for the local community as well as that larger system in which the community is embedded. And there are some powerful ideas out there, some powerful visions. We don't lack the ideas and the ways of living and the ways of structuring an economy that are doable. What we simply lack is the political will, because our politics and our mainstream media is really, you know, has a stranglehold by big money, billionaires and the big corporations.
Yes, it's interesting you say that, and you're probably closer to the ground in terms of seeing these visions and so forth. But I think it has been a criticism of some environmental thinking and thinkers in recent decades of not really being able to offer a vision of what the future would look like or should look like or could look like, and rather having overly focused on the failures of the system and the problems. And I think that is a really important question. And I wonder whether clear visions and ideas that are really in debate and people are thinking about, which presumably is a necessary prerequisite for these kind of changes. But it's, as you say, it's tremendously important to have this vision, something that, you know, and different visions as well that out of this will emerge, you know, hopefully something new, as you say. What's next for you, Jeremy?
Well, I guess speaking of vision, the book that I'm working on currently is one that looks at the deeper layers of understanding a way of finding meaning in life that would lead to that more like sustainable way of flourishing on the earth into the future. So it's a book that's actually its working title is The Web of Meaning, and integrating science and traditional wisdom to find our place in the universe. And what it's really about is, if my last book, The Patterning Instinct, recognized how our underlying worldview right now has led to these imbalances, it looks at how we can actually form a foundations for a worldview that is based on very rigorous modern scientific thinking in system science, in evolutionary biology, in cognitive science, and how that actually looks at the same underlying meaning of an integrated worldview that early wisdom traditions looked at. We find that in traditional Chinese thoughts, in Taoism, in Buddhism, and in indigenous wisdom. So it's offering a kind of an integrated way of making sense of things, rather than splitting between that sort of spiritual stuff and modern science, or splitting between modern Western thought and traditional thought. It actually looks at how an integrated way of understanding our place in the universe can be spiritually meaningful and politically lead to a more sort of flourishing place of connectivity, and an economic system that can allow us to actually live on the earth into the distant future.
Well, that's a fantastic vision, Jeremy, and I wish you the very best of success with that. And thank you so much for a fantastic interview here today.
Yeah, well, thanks. It's been great talking with you, Fergal. I appreciate all the great work you're doing bringing these issues to light. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.